session is intended to be about questions you may have about the health and well-being and details of the village, and just to keep you informed as to what you might want to know about the place. We always start with the mission. This mission statement is about 40 years old, 36 years old, actually. And the heart of it, or the line down in the big paragraph below the blue, the purpose of this community is to participate in the renewal of the church and the world by proclaiming the gospel of God's unconditional love in Jesus Christ, is original to the first Holden mission statement adopted by the corporation in 1961. So that there have been some additions to the statement, but the heart of it is still in that sentence. And the mission statement is reviewed yearly by the Holden Board of Directors. So it's up to date, and this is what we intend to be doing here. I think the first thing I'd like to do is have us introduce ourselves to one another and maybe say something about your association with the village, how long you've been coming, and that sort of thing, so that we get a sense for what your stake is in this place. Would you like to start?
I'm Rosalyn Olson, or Rosie Olson, and I'm just a guest, and I come about every 3 years for the last 25 years or so.
Great. So you go back quite a ways to the village. Mm-hmm. Where's your home?
In Bellevue, Washington. I go to St. Luke's Booth in there.
Yeah. Thank you.
This is our third year of working in the dining hall. And it came in the 70s, I think, for a long weekend.
Does it?
Anyway, one was in the 70s, and you said you'd like to come back and work on the staff, and so 20 years later.
So when I retired, I'd like to come back and volunteer. So.
Yeah, thanks for doing that. As you know, that's the heart of the place.
The year that we were out visiting was the year that you were. Was it? I looked it up.
94. So,
no. We came in 70, but 94.
What was the year that you first came out here?
80. 1980.
Okay. I was here.
Was it?
Because I thought we found his picture, and you and your wife's picture up there.
Oh, we did, but.
Yeah. I thought we said it was the same year.
80 or 81, either one of those.
Number of years ago. Yeah.
So it's more like a vacation than a working thing up here, though.
I was very fun and enjoyable. This year we brought our daughter with us, and with her two sons, and she's, you know, working part time, trying to keep track of our kids.
Yeah.
Good times.
Good. Okay. Others.
I'm Steffi Stevens, and I started coming here in the early 70s for several years. And was on staff and lived here for about 2 years, and then came back once in 1990. And this is the first time I've been back since 1990.
Why don't you tell us about that little place you work at?
I work at a restaurant that I used to be part owner in. It's in Pepin, Wisconsin. And I was a partner with Paul and Carol Hinderly. And Paul was a chef here, and his father was a director here for 15 years. And Paul was a chef here, and we met here, and he ran the kitchen, and I ran the dining room for 2 years, and then we bought a restaurant together. And it's on the Mississippi River, and it's a very pleasant little restaurant.
It certainly is.
Thank you.
And the wonderful food.
Thank you. Just actually, it's also time. Wonderful fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
We do well.
Good.
Thank you.
Mississippi. Yeah, I'm John Matheson, and I first heard about Holden when I came out here from Minnesota to go to LBI back in the late 70s. But I didn't actually get up here until about 1990 when a group of us from our church came up and camped in Ballpark. Mm-hmm. So that was my first experience here. Mm-hmm. And we came, my family came this week as guests. This is the first time we've stayed here. So we've been here a week and we're leaving today.
Yeah, yeah.
And we thoroughly enjoyed our time here.
Good, good. Okay. Mr. Nardine, we didn't get your first name.
Oh, Kermit.
Thanks for coming. Anything else you want to say?
No, I guess that's about it.
Okay.
I'm Herman Larson. My connection with Holden has been more precarious than in presence. I was with Carol Hinderle during his term in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was here, I was in Chicago and I started teaching the accordion. By the time you got around to inviting me to come out to do something on a lecture, I was involved in trips to the Orient. Mm-hmm. I never made it. But I've always been interested in Holden. My first visit was 2 years ago for a few days, and we're back again now for 3 days.
And where are you from now?
Currently living in Gink Harbor. I'm serving as visitation pastor for St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Tacoma, where Lyle Miller, formerly bishop down in the San Francisco area, is pastor. And interestingly, he is one of my former students from Concordia. Mm-hmm. So we have a good relationship.
He was up with a group of parishioners 2 or 3 weeks ago.
About 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And we couldn't make it. We signed up originally to go with it. This is sort of a sop because we missed that trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks.
Well, one thing I thought about, my parents were one of the first, around here, one of the first years it was open. Back in the 60s, so mm-hmm. We've been going around for years.
What was the first year that it was operational?
Well, the corporation was formed in 61, and there were work crews during those early summers, college students primarily, that Carol organized.
Weren't a lot of them mostly, though, from the Pacific Northwest, the work students?
And the Midwest is what I understand.
I know that Gamrath said they've been coming since 63. Mm-hmm. And when I was here in the 70s, there were several people who were from Portland area mm-hmm. who'd come as church groups mm-hmm. in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
in the 60s, we went to some dinner down at Seattle Center, I think, mm-hmm. about Holden mm-hmm. when it was first starting and slides and things.
Yeah. I'm sure that they were probably trying to spread the word and raise the initial funding that it would take to mm-hmm. keep the place going. Gil Berg, a fellow from Seattle, associated with LBI, set his business interests aside for a few years in order to sort of lead crews in mucking the place out. And, but I think it was largely just summer working crews, and I don't know, it would be several years later when they initially started having program. The first program folk being college professors from the Midwest who agreed to come for any number of summers. That's where Beanie and Gertrude Lundholm initially connect, and later on Doris and Rudy Edmond and others. So there were a variety of ways. Gradually, the place opened up and got more deliberate. There's a good book, Sustaining the Surprising Gift by Lutz, that's in our library and the bookstore. And if you really want a copy, there's several copies around, just sitting around too, so it'll get you a good early history of the place through that book. We've just been sharing our initial connection with the village and anything of concern that, or any point of particular interest in the life of the village over the years. Would you like to introduce yourselves? Just start here and go through.
Sure. My name's Paul Orman. I'm from Maverick, Washington. Introduced to Holden probably 15 years ago and been fairly regularly since then. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Comments we can make later, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, good.
Ron Tubby, live in Olympia. My dad was part of the early fundraising and some of the first work parties up here. So. Mm-hmm.
Who did he work with? As who was supervising the work? Did you ever get a sense for who the...
I don't know. I was pretty young then. I don't remember all the details. I just remember coming up good points of Gilbert and some of those guys.
Okay. Good.
I'm Mark Johnson, and I'm from Abbotsford, B.C. Darlene and I started coming here about 17 years ago, I guess.
Okay. Good. Darlene?
And I'm Darlene, goes with Mark. And I'm between.
We celebrated our 21st anniversary, so it was good to be a little part of it.
And I'm on the board now, so I came to get a little, to be refreshed in all the stuff that was new to me in the June meeting. So.
Yeah. Great. Good. Well, as I said in the announcements this morning, I'd like to go with your questions. Is anybody come with a question in mind that they'd like to get us going?
How's the status of the fire?
The fire is out. It did consume about a third of the deck, and they had to cut away probably another third or so to make sure that it was out. But as you look at the deck and the creek ahead of you, the left-hand portion, the left-hand half of that decking was completely consumed in the fire. It's probably fortunate that it was up against the rock there and didn't spread to the woods around because it was up again. So the 10-mile overlook had a fire this morning.
It looks did. Like.
We had a report about 8:25 or so. Someone came in and said that it was on fire. We don't know.
Brand new one.
Yep, the brand new overlooking deck.
Do they have any idea what caused it? Mm-hmm.
No, there's no lightning this morning.
Probably cigarette. Mm-hmm.
So there's something, probably human caused, but there was no apparent reason for it out there. So.
When did they start having a year-round program?
I don't know that, but I would guess it'd be 60...
Late 60s, yeah, I think. Just because my memories of the Grovers having the Lifestylers mm-hmm. were, I think they had more than 5 years of a history of, and those were kids who didn't go to college, but considered this their year of, because that lasted from September to May, June. And that was 70, I would think 69, 60, 70 maybe, late.
What did they do that just came to stay?
Well, no, there was an actual program, a full, it wasn't accredited. But it was a program that dealt with humanities, philosophy, theology, liberal arts, intents for 8, 10, 12 students. I don't think they ever went over 12.
No.
They tried to keep, it was very intimate and intense. And it usually started in September. And these were kids who had graduated, and might be freshmen, sophomore, junior in college, take a year off from college and do that. And they were part of the winter staff. And I know when I arrived in 74, there was full continual, and that already had a history of Lifestylers. So I would think late 60s because. Yeah.
I think that's
it,
right.
It probably took quite a bit to get the buildings to go all through, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. And it was a while before they got the generators. I mean, there wasn't enough electrical power for a long time to do anything. Wes Preep spent a winter here. Terry Saturn spent a couple of winters here, basically alone. It's just a key.
The ultimate isolation.
Yes.
Mr. Watchman.
Yeah. If you got sustaining the surprising gift, I can't.
I've looked through it, but I don't have a copy of it.
I'll get you a copy before you leave. All our board members should have that. That'll have all that early history.
You know, I have a question, since we're somewhat talking about fires, because last night brought back real old memories to me, because, you know...
At least we didn't have to go to the ballpark.
Right, right. But the first thing that came to my mind, muscle memory, was you have to be fully dressed, go out, at least when I was here, you have to think it's a fire. And so I made everybody get up, and I realized, you know, I don't remember and wonder if anybody does when the chalet burned down.
67, wasn't it? 67, just the other day, I heard.
Yeah.
I can never get it straight between that and the garage,
right,
which is 18 or 20 years ago. So I think that one was 76, and I think 89 is, or not 89, I don't know.
I was just trying to remember because...
It was before the present fire suppression system was put in and before the new alarm system. We don't ask, because we have a more particular and localized system now, we don't have to roust the whole village every time a alarm goes off. The staff gets up, but if it's not in your building where the alarm has been sounded, we're asking folks to just stay put. So it's better than when they didn't know precisely where the fire had been triggered and everybody had to move.
Have you ever thought about banning smoking altogether in the village as a precautionary?
That hasn't come up in the board meetings that I've been part of, no.
I would think that might cause more problems because some smokers really... Yeah.
Actually, I did a fire-related question too. This
okay, right there. Go ahead.
I was wondering if there's an evacuation plan if a fire were to start, say, in Lucerne, move up the valley so you can get out that way. Is there a plan in place?
There is an evacuation plan that's reviewed yearly. There are food and water supplies, or at least the containers, standing by, available to be used. That was all brought to heightened awareness in 94 when we had fires around the village, not in the valley. But we did maintain a round-the-clock fire watch during that time. And a plan was developed to basically get people out of the village and up onto the tailings in a basically open area where the fire would theoretically burn around folks. There's very little that is more sophisticated than that, because the assumption is that the fire that's threatening is the one that's coming up valley and has blocked the road, and there aren't too many options at that point. I think that it is possible for them to bring large helicopters in from the Spokane Air Force Base if necessary, but that's about as sophisticated as we're able to manage at this point. Yeah.
I think smoke might be a problem.
Oh yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be a perfect solution. It would just get you out of the main path of the fuel and get you, yeah. I think it includes, you know, wetting down blankets and sitting under those and that kind of thing too. I mean, what you could do for that. There is a pretty good swale up there that's still open right in the first part of Tailings Pile 1. And I think that's where we'd go, down in that, which is a drainage, and would be lower than the surrounding elevations. That's the plan that we have, such as it is. But it is there, and it's reviewed yearly, and people have assigned roles in that. So.
You know, just feedback and come up in 3 years. It's been a real good year. A lot of it's just the people, I think, the character of the village is really representative of the leadership, and it's really well done.
Good, thanks.
Hospitable, back to some real nice basics, and compliments for the hard work that's gone on over the last couple of years. Appreciate it.
Thanks. My only fear is we'd get too boring.
Sometimes we come to get away from some of the hubbub too, so it's...
Yeah.
How can you be bored with the emergency site of fire this
morning? I'd rather people get hot and bothered by a good program. You know? I realize that I don't think we engage with one another in the conversational style that we have been able to do in the past. And I think that's partly because we're different people now, and partly because it's been harder to have conversation with one another. But I, like I say, my fear is that the village becomes boring and just sort of a middle class cheap resort rather than a place where ideas can really be engaged and in an environment of mutual respect and all culminating in worship every day.
And thank you for that experience. I'd share with you. I had a person who came to me and had come to hold on a Saturday night, left on Sunday.
Sorry.
You know, they were meeting in Chelan and were very critical of Holden. And I just sat back and listened because it was of interest to me. And it was very obvious that they didn't understand. You know, the person is in an executive position responsible for buildings and maintenance and that kind of thing. It was very critical of some of the maintenance issues and really never saw the spirit of Holden. It's really interesting to get a different perspective. And it wasn't really worth trying to explain what it was about. But I think the cutest one was that I saw, and I'll share with you, was the mailbox. The comment that the mailbox on the front porch is almost falling off the porch, you know, and that's not a good situation. And we had a kind of a cute thing happen the other day. A son dropped the mail in the mailbox, and the mother said, "Did it go down?" And the kid opened up the side and said, "Yep, it did." Sure. And to me, that's the spirit of Holden. Who cares if it's falling off? It works. Yeah. We just rolled.
That's good. Other questions or comments?
You know, I have a question, and I'm going to preface this with the reality that I live in a small town where there are a huge amount of rumors, and they're frequently totally wrong. And I had heard a long time ago, probably at least 2 years ago, that Vespers was no longer required attendance. Do you know what I mean by that? Because that used to be the word that was used. And really, never heard anything different to that, and was greatly surprised to see Vesper attendance, period, since I've been here. And I'm curious, has anybody told you that rumor is out there, or have you heard that rumor, or do you even know what I'm talking about?
I have not heard that rumor. We regularly...
I'd even like to remember where I heard that rumor from, but I did hear that.
And spring we go back to our long-term staff and revisit that expectation, which all the staff members sign off on when they come as a staff member. The language is expectation, not requirement.
Right.
But so it's somewhat softer than an absolute mandate. But we had some trouble with that in our first year here, summer of late '94, and some in the summer of '95. But since then, it's just a non-issue.
Mm-hmm.
The expectation is there, and generally speaking, it's. Except for those times when people just take the exceptional route and spend the half hour quietly, it's been followed. So I don't know where that comes from or how it would have gotten started.
Right.
There's been no wavering in that since we arrived.
Glad to hear.
There was a little bit of a different contract in the village when we first got here in '94, and I rousted some people.
Mm-hmm.
Myself, up behind some of the chalets, deciding that was a good time to have a cookout and just
mm-hmm.
sit together and drink some beer. But that's not an issue anymore.
Well, it doesn't appear to be, and for me, particularly having been a long-term staff person here for several years, and especially, I just have to say, taking it away from here, you know, the core of my content was that spiritual life, so I was questioning that, and I actually see little change, or if any.
Yeah.
So.
Good. I hope you don't. In that regard, anyway. Other issues or questions, Kermit?
I don't have any
question.
We've
been doing a sustaining the gift, which is the name of this capital fund drive we're presently in. We've been doing a tour every week in order to walk people around the village so that they can actually see where we intend to spend the money. It largely has the beginning of the board's acknowledgement that a funding drive was going to be necessary was the discovery that there was significant oil leakage into the soils around the underground storage tanks, which were mining day origin. And our first estimate from a consultant was that it might cost as much as $500,000 to get that mess cleaned up. If we're lucky, we will finish that project in 2 years this summer with the final screening of the 2,400 cubic yards of dirt that we took out of these holes and put on the third level of the tailings. That soil is being screened and is basically cleansing itself in the sunlight. Nothing else is going to be needed to do the remediation on that soil. So that was a big change. We're fortunate with some California experience showed us that we did not need to do soil winnowing or anything to clean that soil. The remaining tanks, and there are 13 or 14 of them, are under buildings and need to be filled. And we bought a concrete mixer for the garage project because that was the most economical way to get use of that material. And so we can now use that concrete truck also to mix the slurry that will go into those tanks under the buildings. And our goal is to do that in September. The final thing that's happening is that we're monitoring the water quality through three wells drugged by the Bureau of Mines. And so far, those are showing levels of material which do not require any further action on our part. So that big project, which we were afraid might cost as much as $500,000, will be finished this fall, we hope, for about $225,000. But it has cost that much. The second major project was we had received extensions on the Clean Water Act of 1986 for 8 years when we arrived. We got one more, and then they said no more. So we knew that we were in for a filtration system for our water supply, that the adding chlorine to it was not going to be sufficient. And in order to take the last thread of Giardia out of the water, we were going to have to go to some sort of filtering system. After several years of work with the Science and Technology Committee, they came up with the plan that we want to use. It requires a heated shelter for that to happen. So we took the opportunity, the board took the opportunity to identify the longstanding need for a new garage to be built at the same time as the water treatment. So that's what's being built at the second level by the A-frame garage, is that garage which has been needed, and the water filtration. And the water filtration, part of that is about $125,000 for everything associated with that. So those two things really kicked off the need to raise funds. Holden has always raised funds on the side for its capital needs. The operating budget is in the black and doing fine. It does rely on gifts of about $130,000 a year from the three-time-a-year letters which you receive, and which are the annual fund supports the rates basically by balancing the operating budget. The capital budgets have to be raised on the side. 1988, they raised about $800,000, and that was used to put in the new sewer system and the remainder of the improvements associated with the fire retarding system, the sprinklers and everything, and a new water tank up on the third level. So those funds were largely expended at the time we were going to be take over at Holden. We thought there'd be $300,000 in the bank, which is what we need every year in order to make through the cash flow cycle for 1 year. That money was largely used up in 1994 because we lost $80,000 in income in August associated with the forest fires in the area. People simply canceled their reservations and didn't come. And we're fairly vulnerable in there. We need to raise about 80% of our yearly operating income between June 15th and the end of August. And we got knocked out of the saddle for about five of those weeks. So almost $100,000 was quickly used up there. And the remainder came associated with the pulling of these tanks. It was so much a bigger job than had been anticipated that we had to ask for a contractor to come in and help us get the hole closed before the snow flew in the fall of 94. And so we ended up spending $125,000 in there much faster than expected. So that depleted the reserves, and that's the other reason why the board knew we needed to do a capital funding campaign. As you know from the bulletin board up by the dock, we're about halfway where we want to get in the five-year period with in pledges, and the campaign is ongoing in Oregon and California and the Seattle area and in Washington, and we're now into the mail portion of the campaign. So everybody that was here at the village as a visitor last summer or this summer will be receiving an invitation to participate in the campaign by mail.
You also mentioned remodeling of buildings,
mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
that was mentioned on the
yes.
Kiosk. Are those general buildings or specific buildings?
Agape is the highest priority. The roof is leaking very badly and has to be replaced this summer.
Uh-huh.
In addition, it's leaking into the load-bearing walls, and that building is, we've got to get that building taken care of, and mm-hmm. the first thing is the roof. But then the second level of that needs a complete remodel for insulation and just general upgrading. The piping in there is about 90% stuffed full of rust.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom level where the laundry is has been replumbed and rewired. Mm-hmm. So the laundry is okay, but it's the main level there that's in trouble. Then there are four chalets that we'd like to get at. The primary reason to get at those chalets for remodeling is the structural integrity of the buildings. Those buildings with 5 or 6 feet of snow on them carry almost 250,000 pounds of snow, and they're 60-year-old wooden buildings. We have a significant ice damming problem along the edges now, because though we have good insulation in the ceilings, we don't have good insulation in the walls. And the heat is going out the exterior walls up to the eave line and creating ice dams right there. 2 years ago, the whole eave structure on Chalet 4 on the north side just snapped off. And that's the kind of damage we'll face if we don't get those buildings insulated.
Mm-hmm.
To insulate those buildings, it doesn't make any sense to leave the beaver board, which is the original wall board, on there. It has no fire retarding value and no insulating value. So once you tear into the walls to do the insulation, it's time to do the electrical, it's time to do the plumbing and the fire suppression stuff. Chalet 7 has been redone. A variety of responses to the aesthetics on the inside, but it does have thermopane windows now, it does have wall board, it is completely insulated, the structure was assessed, but we need to spend about $35,000 to $40,000 on each of at least four chalets. The other thing that will do is get us out of the woods, and in as far as the large dedication of labor we need every year to producing 130 cords of firewood. Those bottom six chalets are heated by wood through the heart of the winter when our electrical production goes down because of loss of pressure in the system. And we'd like to get people out of the woods doing that dangerous work with heavy equipment, and it requires trucks and big front loaders and all kinds of stuff, and then splitters and mauls and all the time, and chainsaws, and all the time you've got college kids who may or may not know what they're doing with that equipment. It's just dangerous. So that's another side benefit of getting these buildings insulated. If we do those five buildings, the estimate of Steve Tung, our operations manager, was that we might discover we have 30% more available electrical power. That's where the reservoir of power is for us, is in insulating the buildings.
So. I'm just curious about the variety of aesthetic responses.
Gertrude hated it.
Gertrude Rundle? was she specific?
Chalet 7 was hers, and she hated it. And it's too modern. Well, if you went in there, it's not modern at all. It's just, it looks a little more finished because it's got wall board that was painted. But she really had a, and the windows don't have the beautiful wood trim that they used to have because all that came off with it. And so we need to try and do a better job of accommodating that. But they also took the occasion to make that into two separate living quarters, one above the other.
Oh.
And so that there's a stairway through one of the front rooms where it used to be, but a laundry room and that kind of thing. Gertrude was fried over that. She didn't care for that at all.
Uh-huh.
I think she's right to a certain extent. But.
Well, just listening, I can imagine what she's thinking, and that part of that's right. I mean, I definitely understand the insulation and replacing the beaver board. I hate to see the beaver board go.
I mean,
you know, it's not just a part of the history. It does have some unique value to it.
Did you miss it this time?
Oh, the dining room was a little bit of a shock to me. Mm-hmm. It really was. And the windows are okay. It's in terms of that they're great. The size is great. The light still comes in the room. Mm-hmm. And I missed it immediately. I mean, part of it is just because of the lightness in the room, and, you know, and but that's not a big deal. The thing that's most obvious to me is it's close to a generic room. You know what I mean? But
no.
Well, the room could be anywhere in terms of color and wood, mm-hmm. which is basic, natural, white and blonde, you know, and the framings too in the windows and stuff. I mean, I missed them immediately. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say I don't like them. I would say I miss what was there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the dining room. I think I definitely understand Gertrude, and if I had spent many years in a chalet, as she has, I can understand an immediate dislike for something that was just basically what, you know, she said it was too contemporary. I mean, I can understand that.
I think they've never had to paint the outside of those windows with 16 squares.
The maze.
Which I did the first year I was up here.
Yeah. I know, but I love paints. But.
Yeah.
And I clean windows, so. Actually, I cleaned those for years. That's right, I remember that. And all the geranium pots. I was just curious.
We do have the separators that give you the false impression that there are separate panes.
I know.
And we decided not to put them into the dining room. We have them. We decided we liked the visibility sufficiently, but we did consider that. And they're in the upstairs windows
mm-hmm.
on the third level.
My comment, but I noticed the dining room right away after being away for a couple of summers. It was different. But it is nice to be lighter and brighter. It is really a lot nicer to be.
We didn't replace curtains that were in there before. That's one change that would lighten the room up and would have hidden that blonde wood. Aesthetically, it looked to us like the carpenter we had done such a beautiful job with the trim that we decided to leave it there and not cut into the light.
Oh, the drapes were always very darkener in that room.
Yeah.
Major.
Yeah. We did have a committee go through and try and identify the really distinctive pieces of that room that needed to be maintained. And that's why the knotty pine beam covering down the center is still there, and the posts are still the way they were. The coffee urns still in place, the alpenhorn up above the cabinets, things like that. We tried to leave enough present there that people would feel like it was the same room, more or less. Yes.
This morning, I offered to be on dish team. I think you said 11:15 up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, thank you.
I enjoyed being in this.
Thank you. Any other issues for you? I can just give you a little bit of an update on other things if you like.
You know, one question I'd ask is how can you beat the health department's rules to get rid of all the food? I know you've done everything you can do, but that really bugs the heck out of me. Mm-hmm.
Well, the way to beat the rules is to ask everybody's cooperation so that we just don't send it to the table if it's not going to be eaten. Then we can reuse it once, not more than that, but probably most of us at home wouldn't do food more than once anyway either.
You look at the chicken, for example, and it came, you know, large chicken breasts, a lot of people can eat that amount of food. Yeah. You know, it was a real treat on one hand, on the other hand.
Yeah. Usually there's just one piece a piece on the platters, one piece per person. I've actually sat at a table there where the first four people each took two pieces of chicken. And that was it. It was just unbelievable to me. Those were, anyway.
I was generous to a fault. I guess, yeah. And it was to see the food wasted. You know,
yeah. And we had a long conversation in our long-term community in the spring about these issues. And it came up primarily because it's such a hassle to burn the meat waste. But I think we're doing much better. The kitchen is really assessing. They're looking more carefully at what comes back so that they know, they get a measure on the receptivity of the different entrees and this and that, so that there are changes made that way. And then asking people to be more deliberate about taking it to their tables. The use of these ugly blue coffins, we call them, for putting a sneeze guard over the food permits us to reuse buffet food where we could not reuse any buffet food before. So that's an intervention. It's a lot of plastic and they're really ugly and they're breaking and, you know, we don't know if that, it really is a hassle. But the ice machine to keep the food cold and the warm heat on the other things for breakfast is a change, but that again helps with that food waste.
Positive comment in relation to the buffets. I mean, I think they're wonderful.
Good.
Well, they're certainly more efficient. I mean, in terms of all the people, summer population coming in, and I mean, I don't like to look at it, but you come in and it used to just be the centerpiece and throngs of people trying to get to the whatever the buffet food was. So, I think it's much more efficient.
It's no different than the barbecue. It's really cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, breakfast is, right, yeah, is rather than separate settings. I mean, yeah, you can come kind of at your leisure. And,
yeah,
and
that's been very well received.
It's, I think, a positive change. And building your own lunch for hiking the next day.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Again, I think very positive change.
How about making your own bed when you come in?
We made it when we left before.
It used to be the other way around.
Fine.
Some people have complained that seems less hospitable to them. The change was made largely at the suggestion that it, number one, allowed people to make the bed the way they wanted it to be made rather than the way somebody else made it for them. And number two, it was in regards to health, you're the one who touches your own sheets at that point and not someone else. So that's why the change was made, but we kind of go back and forth on that one. Like you say, you're going to do it at the front end or the back end. Not a big deal.
That was a non-issue.
Is that salmon that we're having really expensive? I mean, it's such a treat.
It's not expensive. It's actually a great example of eating in season. That's the food that's out there.
It's chicken, isn't it?
Yeah. Last summer, at the end of the summer, we were getting it for $1.50 a pound. Mm-hmm. Chum. Out of Alaska. I don't know if it'll be that good this year. We don't pay more than $4 a pound. We do that once or twice in the spring when King is out. That's usually worth it. But yeah, it's good food and it's in season and it's plentiful and it's not that expensive. And it's really been received well.
And it's received well.
on food setting, having the fruit available is a real bonus.
Yeah, good.
At all times of the day.
Yeah.
That's much appreciated.
Yeah, I've had two.
And a strong coffee.
And a strong coffee, yeah. How could I forget?
It does bring a question, though. Hasn't increased the food budget a lot to make the changes over what it was 8 or 9 or 10 years ago?
I'd have to go back and track that. During our 3 years, we're actually fairly stable or less. Brent Wiersmaier, business manager, who's been here with us the whole 3 years we've been here, has reduced the budget every year. So he's really been tight-fisted, and by forcing the food purveyors to bid against one another in a competitive environment, we're getting a better deal this way and that. And some other changes, we order different cuts of meat for this and that, but basically we're doing fine. It's about a third of the operating budget is our food cost. Just over $300,000 a year.
One of the saving factors would be the emphasis on fresh in season,
yes,
is less expensive. And thinking about back then with all the unusual foods, I bet you paid a premium just on it being unusual.
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't tried to track that at all. I know that we had lots of huge bins of raw grains that were kept downstairs, and they weren't finding a way to use those very efficiently. That was, and for this business manager, that was holding too much inventory besides. And
They don't grind their own meat anymore?
Yeah, we do grind
it.
Not all the time, but regularly enough.
Okay.
There's not as much fun experimentation with the bread as there used to be, I think. I would say that over the years we probably standardized the food more than before.
I know when Paul started back and took over, and we started having a lot of fresh food as opposed to as much canned food as we had, he kept the budget. But the canned food was much higher, which was a long time ago. I mean, that would have been 22 years ago. So, he had an intention of cutting the budget because I don't know what it was, but they felt, I think the board felt it was high at the time, that the food costs were high, which is something. He likes that kind of challenge anyway.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a problem with the math challenge.
It's pretty much a non-issue in the last 3 years. The food is being well received, and Scott Hosrud, in the last year of his tenure here, brought in a nutritional consultant, and they did move to more standardized menus. Mark Getches, who's been our food service director for 2 years and a cook for 2 years before that, has shown good leadership in the kitchen, so I think it's going well.
Well, our experience has been very brief, but the contrast between the few meals we've had now since we came up and 2 years ago, the food seems to be improved quite a bit.
So, good.
More palatable, more variety.
Yeah.
Served well.
Trying to pay attention to it. Again, the balance is between, part of what we all loved about this place early on was the quirkiness of the place too. The strange stuff that you got to eat and then discover that you liked. But we haven't had Holden runs in seasons, just as we're not as able to provide for the kind of music of meals that we did when Beanie Lundholm was alive and had the spirit of bringing that music to the table. We don't have a David Christian or Paul Hinderly in the kitchen who wants to make that an intentional part of the mission. That isn't a particular gift that we have right at this time.
So it could
flow back the other way in terms of the food being more deeply part of the mission of the place, lower on the food chain, that whole notion.
It's pretty low, though. It's a good example. It really is a good example for families to go home to and think about, because it's doable. It's something that people will tolerate.
Yeah. Yeah. I was not a soup person before I came, and I've learned that a regular lunch of soup and bread and fruit is, that's a completely acceptable lunch, you know. Maybe that's the kind of thing you're talking about you can go away with. Holden operates on a 20-year use permit from the Forest Service. The present permit we're on expires in 2003. Doing a capital campaign, we thought that that was a little tight. We weren't quite able to make the argument that folks ought to be generous in sharing with the village. And we couldn't guarantee them that we'd be here more than 3 or 4 more years. So we've begun the process, and probably will have by the end of the summer a new 20-year permit. And so just for your information, we intend to be here for a while. Holden has a good relationship with the Forest Service. They're very pleased with the way we contribute to getting people into the backcountry and to fulfilling that part of their mission, really in service to the public and getting folks into the mountains. So that relationship is still very, very good. And so I think we're still moving ahead. We're experiencing some change, which I put under the broad rubric of institutional development. We're trying to be more conscious, and some of that leads to a standardization and a normalization. The blonde wood is sort of a metaphor for that in some ways. We think Holden is at a place in its life where we face some fairly significant challenges for the future, and we better regularize some processes, and we better get some planning going. We better anticipate the future further ahead than we have in the past if we intend to be here. And that's part of the rationale behind an upgrading in our fundraising capacity then as well. You'll see in late November, early December, a significant upgrade in the appeal associated with the annual fund. The consultants who worked with us on the capital fund tell us we should easily be raising twice as much or 2.5 times as much in annual giving as we are. And so we're going to try and go at that. The idea being that if we upgrade that giving, we can stabilize rates and continue to make this a diverse bunch of folk who come here rather than just middle class folk. And we will have to do capital campaigns less frequently because we'll be able to pay for more of our capital needs out of operating income and gift income at the annual fund level. So, but we are going to hope to get a good long-range building plan in place that is responsible and takes into account the fact that these are 60-year-old buildings now and won't be getting any younger. They'll get older, and if we want the place to be around, we're just going to have to attend to it. But I think the future is good. There's big issues going on associated with the tailings this summer. The successors to the mining company are being pressured by the U.S. government to do something, and by the Washington state government to do something about the tailings and get us to a solution as to their presence in the valley and how they can be best either accommodated in the valley or shipped out or whatever has to be done.
Is that the Holden family that you're talking about?
No.
The successor to?
Successor to the Howe Sound mine.
To the Howe Sound.
Mm-hmm. A French-owned corporation named Alumet now owns those claims or owns and the liabilities and the assets of Howe Sound.
Okay.
And so real significant scientific study has been going on this spring and will continue this fall to get a complete picture of what the tailings are, what kind of threat they represent, and what might be done to them to normalize them in the valley, if that is the goal. And then, of course, historic costs associated with that will have to be spread around, too. And Holden should be free of that. We're not the defendant in that case with the government, but we're also trying to stay out of the way of getting mixed up in that. Mm-hmm. So we're pursuing an independent course through our legal advisors to settle with the U.S. government in anticipation of this other litigation for any claims the government may have with us. We think we'll be able to get out of that fairly handily. We do know that we have some liabilities there. We had a landfill, for instance, up in the tailings for many years. We do spread our sewage sledge down on the third tailings pile as part of a Forest Service study to see if that doesn't assist in the revegetation. We did put the soils up on the third level. We do own 80 acres on the mountainside here, which is the patented claim, which was part of the gift of the buildings to Holden. And we know we've got water running out of the portal there that has to be dealt with. So there are some things that we'll be addressing as a village, but then I think you can expect to see something big. This time next summer, we'll probably be all a Twitter about what level of intervention should be taken by Alumet to address the tailings. And that's all going to be based on the science, whether the tailings are internally stable, how the drainage is working that's presently out there, how the revegetation is taking root, and where the river is that continues to flow under the lowest part of the tailings, whether there's significant erosion. Those are all the issues that are being assessed now. So more information to come on that, but it's exciting to think that there could be a good solution to the environmental scar that's there.
Another quirkiness of the village. Yeah.
You know, the accessibility of Holden really isn't accessible to some people, and I'd be curious if there's been any thought about adjusting the fees up slightly to provide for uncompensated visits that would be charitable in a way, in the interest of really adding diversity to the village. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people would be willing to just put a 2% or 1% increase in the dues to share. You know, young families that are single people that really don't have the means to support and can't use the volunteer period, even the longer volunteer period. Mm-hmm. Accessibility is, I think, a big issue.
Yeah.
And it's easy, it can be funded in a way that isn't onerous maybe to anybody, but allows to give back.
The place where we've run into a rub on that is standards for how to determine who should get a scholarship and who hasn't. Rather than going that way, which is higher fees and a scholarship program, mm-hmm. the strategy has been to use the annual fund income to subsidize the rates and keep it low for everyone, and then ask those who do have the capacity to pay more to make a gift as part of their annual budget.
I guess I challenge that thought back a little bit, because some people, for a family of four, it was $800, and it may be subsidized, but if you're making $12,000 a year, you don't have $800 to come to hold, and that doesn't make those people any. And I, we heard in Bible study, a little bit of a challenging and in a nice way, I think that might be the, I would say maybe giving back. There's got to be a mechanism to make the determination.
Keep your eye out for one, and we will too. We know that people don't. We know that the notion of a subsidized rate is not necessarily the most popular strategy for dealing with this issue. And so we are on the lookout for what else can be done.
We do that through we have a preschool in our church. It has about 200 kids involved, and we use that mechanism. And to be honest with you, it's totally judgmental at the discretion of the director. And many of those people that do get here in preschool are urged to contribute and volunteer some time. But sometimes you just have to bite the bullet and make a discretionary decision. And I know you've done that in a number of situations, but that's the mechanism that made it work. It may work, it may not work.
We presently do give away about 500 nights a year. We give away a significant to folks like kids from the Boys and Girls Clubs in Yakima, which helped introduce some Hispanic kids to mountains. And,
that's great.
And that, and but and so we have used that as a multicultural level lever.
It's not easy to give to make the decision.
Well, just the staff time to do it, to assess them, even, is what is not present when you're working with 45 adults through the winter.
Yeah, but isn't this work program where the parent works half time?
That's another tactic that we've taken, is to try and open the volunteer service to single family parents and others by requiring a partial work day, and then using Narnia, in essence, as a place to have the kids have a good experience while a parent worked. That's a limited program, though. It is there, but those slots, they do fill up quickly. They're the first ones, the first volunteer slots to fill every year are those.
I think that's a fantastic service right there. I mean, it's
that's
free.
Similar to what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If someone wants to come in free, I think they're willing to work.
I agree.
It's the best.
The strategy is also driven by a kind of a touchy equation over how many beds in the village are dedicated to staff and attendant dependents, and how many can be income producing during this 10 to 12 week period when we've got to earn the year's income. That's the other hassle. We can be extraordinarily generous outside that 10 week period, and we do give away lots of nights in the spring and in the fall. But during that one time is when it's so difficult that we just have to earn our income then. So,
not-for-profit counseling service in Abbotsford, when you on their form and people come to sign up, it's like they say your income level and you tick it off. This is your rate. It's basically on an honor system to. You know what your rate is, and if your income is, you shouldn't be subsidized if you're over a certain level. And I don't think the people that are coming here are going to say, I only make $20,000 to be able to get into the low rate.
Yeah.
At least I don't think.
That may be one of those things that's possible with the next business manager. This business manager chose to address those issues by cutting costs. He was not comfortable that there was enough predictability in that system to build a budget for the year, and so we relented.
But if you were getting pressure, for example, to increase your rates, maybe maybe what you're saying can't increase them well, maybe this is a way you can get some increase and leave your minimum level at where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying use it for the upside.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.